it makes no sense at all. It hasn't made sense from the start. People who were specialists of microwave ovens could focus so much the discussion of something so complex as biological effects of electromagnetic radiation generally on something so restricted as heat with such ridiculous arguments challenges the imagination. You are required to circulate electron currents and proton currents. Both of these are charges that go through essentially water. If you have these currents circulating, these fluids are conductors. If they are conductors, they will be sensitive to electromagnetic radiation if it penetrates within the body. We know that many types of radiation penetrate into the body.
Welcome to the Richie Flow Nutrition Podcast. My name is Cameron Borg. On this episode, I had the pleasure of speaking with Paul Heroux. Paul is a physicist and toxicologist with particular interest in the biological effects of electromagnetic energy. He is an associate professor at McGill University's Faculty of Medicine and also a medical scientist in the Department of Surgery of the McGill University Health Center. Paul has spoken eloquently on the fallacies perpetuated within the scientific community surrounding the biological effects relating to man-made electromagnetic energy, namely that 1. Non-ionizing radiation is biologically inert, 2. That the energy supplied is insufficient to overcome thermal energy, and 3. That these exposures cannot cause sufficient heating within the tissue. These claims ignore basic principles of physics and are scientifically indefensible. Paul's work also focuses on public health, bringing more awareness to the unchecked advancement of the telecommunications and energy industries and the threat they pose to all life on Earth. His in vitro work has clearly demonstrated that extreme low-frequency radiation, such as power lines, induce broad changes in basic physiological processes, the consequences of which are yet to be appreciated. Before we start, please consider subscribing to my Substack, where I share further insights into these podcast topics and provide a depth of information not possible here. This is the best way to support myself and the podcast. With all this being said, I hope you enjoy the episode. Paul, thanks so much for giving me some of your time today. I've really been looking forward to getting the chance to speak with you. We met briefly at the Water Conference last year, and I thought your talk was one of my favorites at the whole conference because you laid out so many things that made so much sense to me with regard to how electromagnetic energy can have biological effects. And the way you laid it out made it very easy to understand, which I really appreciated. But before we get to that, I guess I want to know a little bit about your background and how you first got the inkling that perhaps these man-made electromagnetic energies might be having biological effects.
Well, I was trained originally in physics, but after getting a BSc in physics, I did graduate studies with a University du Québec in Montreal, which is an outfit that was associated with a research institute with power lines, a power utility research institute. So I got a whiff of engineering there. And as I was studying engineering, I realized that there were biological effects concerns lurking around the utility that they were not very comfortable looking at. And actually, IREC, the institute in which I did my graduate studies, had a very, very open view of training their scientists. And I got hired there, and they allowed me to go to the Faculty of Medicine at the University of Montreal to so to speak, widen my horizons and to follow courses by mail in biology and all these things. I also followed courses in biology at University of Montreal, supported actually by the utility. And all of this set me up for a project that the power industry had on electrical burns. You know, they wanted to know if they could help the utility victims and, of course, the public victims of electrical burns. So I sort of got interested in this subject. That connected me with the Royal Victoria Hospital in Montreal, where I got very, very interested in the subject. And I guess intellectually, what really hooked me was the work of Samikna and Kiselev in Russia, where they determined that weak magnetic field altered the structure of water. And this is not something that is very well promoted when the utilities, I mean, it seems to be beside the point, but it's something very fundamental because it relates to the motion of protons from one molecule of water to another. And these effects that they detected on pure water, I detected experimentally at the Royal Victoria Hospital on all human cancer cells. In other words, comparable thresholds of exposure yielded biological changes that corresponded to changes in the ability of protons to move from one molecule of water to another. So I thought, looking at this work, that I had something that was solid from the physics point of view, and my interest in this area increased afterwards.
When you're talking about the movement of protons in water molecules, what is this called, and when does it happen in biological systems?
Well, in pure water, it's called the Grotthuss mechanism, which means that in pure water, water molecules decompose and recompose about 2,000 times per second. In living systems, the motion of protons is of enormous importance. First, there is only the primary structure of protein that is determined by the sequence of amino acids. The secondary, tertiary, and quaternary structure of proteins, if you know what these are, how you pack these linear assemblies of nucleic acids, how you do it, well, that is all determined by hydrogen bonding. Hydrogen bonding is essentially the transfer of protons from one molecule to another. So if you weaken that or you interfere with that, such as magnetic fields can do, even at very, very low intensities, down to 20 nanotesla, then you have something that is very, very powerful. The second reason is that in oxidative phosphorylation, you are producing adenosine triphosphate on the basis of the flow of protons through complex 4, otherwise known as ATP synthase. ATP synthase is a protonic motor, analogous to an electric motor, except that it has protons flowing through it. And the alpha channel of that component is very, very strange in that even at 30 degrees centigrade, it has the same structure as ice. It is the water in the nano channel is confined to have the same structure as ice, which presumably is a way for nature to make the transfer of protons through this channel as efficient as possible. So I was always fascinated by the fact that if you can impair the motion of protons through bulk water, probably you can do it even more effectively through a nano-confined water channel that is specifically designed for transparency. So I still believe that this particular aspect is influential, as is, of course, the influence of electric fields on the electron transport chain within oxidative phosphorylation. Of course, electrons are lighter. They can be moved by much smaller fields, but the situation of protons in this circuit is very, very interesting.
I suspect when you're talking about the ability of these fields to change the composition of water, the structure of water, this is somewhat analogous to what Jerry Pollack and a lot of the other people at this conference were talking about with these various structural changes. Jerry emphasizes this charge separation event. Is this the sort of thing that we're talking about with electromagnetic energy, or is it the opposite?
I think what Jerry is studying and what I have been studying in relation to the fields are very, very tightly grouped. Of course, in science, there's many ways to look at the same thing. So he's looking at it more from the point of view of interfacial effects. But even in relation to the health effects of electromagnetic fields, it seems clear to me that the opacity of the stern layer that is occurring on the inner membrane of mitochondria as a result of the polarization of protons by the membrane is a very important aspect that leads to the easy flow of protons from complexes 1 and 3 to complex 5. So, of course, all of these aspects of polarization of membranes and proton mobility have a lot in common, a lot of things to uncover there.
What I found really interesting about your talk was you sort of took the biggest, subtractive things as far as the effects of electromagnetic fields. In the literature, there's this idea that these fields are non-ionizing. They are too weak to overcome thermal energies, and there are no mechanisms to explain how they would have any effects. And you went through and sort of explained the fact that these are quite erroneous in such a simple and elegant way. And I was wondering if you could sort of recapitulate a little bit of that.
No. That's not what I want to do. I want you to explain to me how such gross concepts could be survive for so long in the public sphere and in the public's mind. Because when you really get down to it, these ideas are so wrong that it is, I guess we have to have respect for the people promoting these wrong things, that they did this very, very artfully, because it makes no sense at all. It hasn't made sense from the start that people who were specialists of microwave ovens could focus so much the discussion of something so complex as biological effects of electromagnetic radiation generally on something so restricted as heat, which with such ridiculous arguments challenges the imagination.
I think there is a lot to be said about the incestuous nature of science and industry in this conversation.
Yes.
And, the fact that there is sort of this liability shield with as far as the telecommunications industry and the effects of their technologies on the health of the public, these are clearly conflicts of interest and certainly not looking out for human health. So you can kind of see why there is such a strong push to uphold these antiquated ideas. That, how could you possibly think we could understand something as complex as the interaction between novel electromagnetic fields and life in general? It sounds, on the face of it, to be a ridiculous thing to posit that we completely understand it. And as long as there is no ionization or no heat or insufficient heat, that there couldn't possibly be any effects. So from your perspective, what are the mechanisms that do not require ionization energy and do not require excessive heat in order to induce biological effects?
Well, it's very, very simple, really. What you have to see the body as, the body is not simply dipoles that you can heat with microwaves, as happens in a microwave oven. The body, if it is alive, has to circulate electrons and protons in order to maintain ATP, which is basically the currency of life. Without ATP, your cells die, the organism, the tissue, everything dies. So you are required, if you are alive, to circulate continuously electron currents and proton currents. Both of these are charges that go through essentially water or, if you will, biological fluids. If you have these currents circulating through these fluids are conductors, right? If they have currents there, if they are conductors, they will be sensitive to electromagnetic radiation if it penetrates within the body. We know that many types of radiation penetrate into the body. the magnetic fields of power systems penetrate the body almost unchanged. So there's complete penetration. And in the case of the radio frequencies, although the thermal component might not go very, very deep, it might, in the case, for example, of 5G, be limited to a millimeter or so, the modulation components of the signal can penetrate deeper. So I would say the agenda of the discussions has been controlled by industry, restricting essentially the area of discussion to things that they wanted to discuss. And you have to see it from their point of view. Industry is not interested in biology. Industry is not interested in human health. They're interested in commerce, in, you know, selling stuff and in providing power. And for them to go into subjects like public health and biology, it's really very, very daunting to them. They wanted to restrict the discussion as much as they could. And what they were looking for is not an answer to the effects of electromagnetic radiation on health. They were looking for a simplification of the problem that would allow them to deal with the situation with their own tools and with their own people. And so this is what they did. But I think there is something wrong morally with what was done.
I couldn't agree more. And, you know, my lack of physics background might catch up with me here, but it seems like a very, very basic principle in physics is that when you apply a field to charged particles that are moving, it's going to affect the way that they move. Is that sort of the general idea of how fields are affecting moving charges?
It's not the general idea. It's exactly the idea, in the sense that this is called the principle of superposition. If you have a field that is moving charges and you apply another field, the effect will be superimposed. And so we know from the structure of metabolism that all living systems, and this is very extensive, there is no living system that does not depend on the flow of electrons and protons. All living systems, if you suppress these currents, the tissue is dead. So this is what defines life in a functional way. Of course, you have genetic definitions of life as well. But in terms of active life, it is electric current and protonic current together in all living systems that define life. So if you have this requirement, it is incredibly gross to put forward the idea that electromagnetic fields on living systems will not be of importance unless they are at the thermal level. It makes no sense at all.
I think that just highlights how absurd it is, because we're talking about one of the most basic physics principles, you know, highlighting how, you know, clear it is that man-made fields are going to affect the movement of charges throughout the body. And I think that you might even be able to argue that the movement of charges is what defines life in some sense. So, you know, it really shows how absurd this idea is, that there couldn't possibly be any biological effects when, by definition, when you apply them to the very thing that defines life, it is going to alter the way that that works. So, you know, I can see, and, you know, you highlighted it so well in your talk, and it just made me realize how incestuous that relationship between industry and the science that's coming up must be in order to uphold, like you said, how is something like this held on for so long? I think it is starting to turn around. I think if you ask the average person on the street, if you hold your phone up and have a conversation on your mobile phone, is that a good thing? They'd probably say, you probably shouldn't do it all the time, which is an acknowledgement that there's some sort of effect going on. But, you know, perhaps the severity of that effect, particularly at a population level, might not be well understood.
Yeah. The thing is that the idea that electromagnetic radiation interferes with living systems can be justified on basic principles of physics and our knowledge of biology. So we talked already about the principle of superposition, which comes out of the structure of Maxwell's equations, highly respected in physics and engineering, and the existence of free radicals within biological systems is a requirement of the second law of thermodynamics, which is an equally respected principle of physics. So basically, if industry had studied the problem in a serious way outside their parochial interests, they would have come to the conclusion, and maybe they did, that these effects were inevitable. But although the effects are inevitable, they avoided the discussion of how to deal with them to ensure that the public is not harmed. So in my opinion, we have been living to at least 100 years of exposure to this radiation, initially at low frequencies and then at increasingly large frequencies, sustaining the consequences to our health, because I believe that the rates of various diseases that we have at the moment are influenced by this progressive decay of our environment, using what we call in general the non-natural electromagnetic radiation. And you could argue that, well, we'll create a new environment and life will just have to adapt to it. After all, as some people in industry would say, this is the cost of doing business. But unfortunately, the cost is primarily paid by increases in various diseases that humans are the victims of as a result of this environment. And engineering is capable of reducing non-natural electromagnetic fields if it has the will to do so. It cannot do so overnight, but it can. Engineering is nothing if not flexible. It's just that they have been allowed to run free without any supervision by governments or serious investigative science. And although there are many people who warned them about this, they were never taken seriously.
What's the relationship between the various parts of the spectrum? I know we've got, you know, radio frequencies, microwaves, and we've also got this other element in this data compaction strategy that is, you know, increasingly a problem as we move from generation 4 to 5 and inevitably to 6. What is the relationship between the different spectral components and what different effects they might have on biological systems?
Okay, so the electromagnetic spectrum covers a wide range of frequencies. We have had about 3 billion years to accustom ourselves to the radiation from the sun that is on Earth. So we can deal apparently with the static field of the Earth. We can deal with the radiation from the sun. But in my opinion, this is an adaptation. I think that all living systems are reluctant to receive energy inputs from outside, because biological systems are organizations that are based on chemistry. And if you disturb chemistry, well, you have the potential to do something that is disturbing or negative. So we have, over billions of years, adapted ourselves mostly to the radiation from the sun. But you notice that we're not completely adapted to the ultraviolet components that come from the sun. This is ionizing radiation. And if you do experiments on the effects of various light frequencies on biological systems, they're not the same at these various frequencies. So there is a complexity in there that needs to be studied, understood, and unraveled. So indeed, as you point out, it seems that the lower frequencies are potent in terms of disturbing biological processes, because biological processes in general do not happen at gigahertz frequencies. They are not incredibly fast. Although you will still see effects at those frequencies, the lower frequencies, which are contained within the modulation of telecommunication signals, seem to be more powerful. But in my opinion, all radiation, be it ionizing radiation as particles or electromagnetic radiation or even sound, all of these things are disturbances to living systems and should be taken seriously in terms of potential negative effects. The genius of life is that we have designed chloroplasts that can use the radiation that is fundamentally hostile to fuel ourselves and, in fact, to benefit ourselves. A lot of people believe that the fact that our windows shield us from red light is something that is negative, because red light apparently stimulates complex four. But, you know, we are beginning to understand all these things. But there's a lot of research to be done, not least of which because there's a therapeutic pendant to electromagnetic radiation. So a bioelectromagnetics department in a university would study both the bad effects of radiation and the therapeutic effects of radiation.
You pointed out in your talk that you don't think it's a coincidence that the absorption minimum in water, it corresponds exactly to the visible solar spectrum. What are the implications of the fact that water absorbs strongly past the visible portion of the sun, and the fact that now we're getting bombarded, we're swimming in electromagnetic energy that is strongly absorbed or relatively strongly absorbed by water?
This is a very brave hypothesis that I put forward, because you have water. Water is the same probability throughout the universe. Water has a lot of transparency in the visible part of the spectrum and tends to absorb energy almost everywhere else. That means that with the sun that we have, water is particularly quiescent. It's a very calm environment. And if you believe that this calm environment of a solvent was really important in generating life on our planet, you may put forward the hypothesis that this spectrum is necessary for life to evolve in a very complete and sophisticated way. So that would mean that the Drake equation that determines the probability of life appearing on a planet could be restricted to planets that circle suns that are relatively comparable to our own. If you have a very, very red sun or a very white sun, it wouldn't work as well, because there is more absorption of this radiation in the water matrix within which life is trying to organize. So this is basically an interesting coincidence that our sun matches the transparency of water, isn't it?
I thought it was a really interesting idea. And, you know, I've spoken to a lot of people who focus their interests on the impact of near-infrared and infrared light on biology. And I've been shown a lot of graphs about the absorption spectrum of water and how the wavelengths of light that appear to be very biologically active correspond exactly to those that generate reactive oxygen species, probably as a result of improving metabolism. So it was something that made a lot of sense to me intuitively, having known that, you know, the absorption spectra of water is very interesting when you go past the visible light.
Now, would you like an even more provocative hypothesis?
Please, yes.
Okay. Do you know of the Fermi paradox?
I do. I've heard a few very interesting ideas to try and explain it to do with hormesis.
Okay. So the reason why when we point our radio telescopes to the heavens, we do not perceive any artificial signal. It's not that there isn't any life out there. It's not that there aren't any civilizations out there. It's that the life that is in the universe is either too primitive to produce this radiation or too advanced. They're so advanced that they know not to use it in broadcasting because it is deleterious to health. So you could see our epoch at this time as a brief moment in time when we are naive enough to impair our environment using this type of telecommunications. Smart people would use optical fiber, you know, and perhaps Li-Fi for mobility. They would use microwaves because they know physics better than we did, you know, when the IEEE set its standards.
That's very brave indeed. But I'm really glad you shared that, because that's a very thought-provoking idea. And it seems to make sense that it's kind of like the idea that the reason, you know, we haven't been visited by super intelligent life is because, you know, by the time they get intelligent enough to make themselves comfortable, the hormetic stresses that keep them healthy go away, and then they die. So I really like these ideas about the Fermi paradox, because I feel like they can explain quite a bit about, you know, life and where we're at as well. I wanted to ask you about mitochondria. In your slides, you mentioned that we probably have somewhere up to 18 to the power of 18 ATPases in our bodies, which is it's beyond what you can really imagine. You can't really conceptualize a number that large. But it just makes you realize that these charges that are moving in our body are it's quite serious. It's not negligible in any sense. And is the general hypothesis that when we're exposed to things like, you know, let's say we're sitting next to a Wi-Fi router, is the general hypothesis that the smoothness of the movement of those charges through the respiratory complexes is perturbed to some degree, basically slowing down the flux of charge through the mitochondria?
Well, you could say that you're slowing them down in one mitochondrion or circuit and accelerating it in another. But whether it's slowing down or accelerating, it's a perturbation. In other words, you are taking a physiological system and you're moving it in a different field environment, and so the result will not be the same. So you cannot expect that application of an external field on an array of all such currents will be neutral. You know, it is a perturbation. So you would take all of these mitochondria at the same time outside their normal operating range, whether it's positive or negative. So this is what we see. And what we observe in populations is the fact that the most obvious effect of this these radiation exposures are with people who are electrosensitive. And the nervous system is the system that depends on mitochondria in the most acute and quantitatively the most... The nervous system needs more ATP more rapidly than any other tissue. So electromagnetic radiation will have impacts on all tissues, but most acutely on the nervous system. And this is why we have people called electrosensitive who react to these fields more visibly than the rest of us. For the rest of us, the effects are more chronic. And one more thing to worry about is, if we continue to do this over centuries, what impact will it have on epigenetics and even on genetics themselves? Because when you alter the efficiency of oxidative phosphorylation, you are tinkering with a system that is absolutely basic to all life forms.
What underlies electro-hypersensitivity? I'm living in Sweden, which I believe at the moment is the only country to recognize it as an actual condition. But, you know, I've seen some hypotheses about, you know, what makes some individuals more susceptible to others. But do we have an idea about where this might lie and how people might be able to tell what's going on?
Well, Dikala has done some studies on electrosensitive populations, and he's found that some mutations in glutathione genetics, the fact that you have absence of these tools within cells that are able to remove reactive oxygen species, the people who are electrosensitive are more likely to have these mutations in their bodies. And I think this is dead on. I think that there are genetic variations among us. They are not classified as mutations because these changes in the genetic structure happen commonly enough that we classify them as variations. So there is a subpopulation of humans that is more susceptible because they are less able to deal with reactive oxygen species. And then there is the immune aspect or understanding of immunity and of all the cells that surround it is very, very sketchy. So in hypersensitive people, it's probable that this lack of controlling reactive oxygen species gets detected by the immune system and elicits a reaction that can amplify over time. This is not different from people who are exposed to chemicals who develop hypersensitivity. And if they are not protected, they can be completely disabled. They have to change jobs because they can't be exposed to isocyanates anymore. This is something that we know very, very well as an out-of-control reaction of immunity. Probably the same thing happens in the people who are electrosensitive to the extreme. They can barely tolerate 1 microwatt per square meter.
Something that I think is becoming more well accepted is this idea that putting your phone in your pocket is impairing your reproductive health. And it seems quite clear that that type of radiation from your phone does impact things like sperm motility. And, you know, I guess the real question is, how is this happening? And are there sex differences between the same type of exposure?
The impairment of fertility is equally possible in women. But the real question is, why have we been ignoring this for so long? Because the file on a connection between sperm health and electromagnetic radiation is quite substantial. And fertility worldwide has been declining all the time. The only explanation why electromagnetic fields are not taken into account is that there is a mass of research and attention focused on chemicals at this point in history. And it's very, very difficult to wrestle these resources for research away from the people who have them right now. So people who are studying chemical aspects of reproductive failure want to continue to do this, and they don't know anything about electromagnetic fields, and they don't know the literature, and they will not be diverted from their from what they're used to unless something dramatic happens.
Are they damaging sperm through, you know, the generation of reactive oxygen species, or is there something intrinsic to the morphology of the sperm that makes them susceptible to these fields? Like, what is it that actually impairs them?
Well, any system that divides rapidly, you know, is vulnerable to electromagnetic radiation in some ways. And you know that sperm, of course, in terms of their mobility, there's a small number of mitochondria in them. And if you impair the function of these mitochondria, you will obviously impair their motility. And then there is the fabrication, the spermatogenesis, that is a very active process. Cells that divide are in danger, fundamentally. So if you are generating spermatozoa over a couple of months or something, you will indeed create some that are defective. This is not something. And in fact, if you look at the early literature, even on ELF radiation, Wertheimer has documented the fact that these magnetic fields could have impacts on embryology, on, you know, on malformations and things like that. So when cells are dividing more rapidly, as cancer cells are, they are more likely to be victims of environmental agents. I have shown that all cancer cells are sensitive to very low levels of magnetic fields. Their karyotype changes, which is already something very, very important.
I guess the fact that sperm cells are so vulnerable, let's say, perhaps because of their low number of mitochondria relative to other cell types, it's sort of the canary in the coal mine telling us that there are genuine effects going on here, and they just happen, you just happen to see it more in them because they have fewer mitochondria to rely on. Is that, does that make sense? Or
yes, it makes sense. And you have to realize also that epidemiology is very good at detecting, I would say, biological effects of various agents once they know more or less how it happens. If it's just, I would say, a very wide screening, it's not very, very easy to detect effects unless they are very, very strong with very high specificity. In the case of electromagnetic radiation, you are dealing with general disturbances in many body systems. I have pointed out oxidative phosphorylation as something very vulnerable, but I'm sure there's many other mechanisms underlying these effects. So as we uncover them, we'll realize that effects are generalized on possibly most of the diseases that we know now. Some diseases might either even be reduced by the exposure to radiation. But if experience serves, when you introduce a non-natural agent, you know, to a species, usually the problems overshadow the advantages.
I've seen some work coming out of Wendy Bean's lab looking at the impact of magnetic fields on reactive oxygen species signaling and behavior. And it does seem that, you know, when you change the magnetic field, you can change the way that reactive oxygen species behave. And that, I guess that kind of makes sense from a physics point of view. These are, things with unpaired electrons, and they're going to behave differently in different magnetic field strengths. And I wonder how this might apply to the importance of reactive oxygen species in their roles in signaling, particularly in signaling for apoptosis and so forth.
Yes. Well, apoptosis can be triggered indeed by, you know, either fast, you know, molecules external to the cell, or by an imbalance in reactive oxygen species within. You have to realize that the five complexes that underlie oxidative phosphorylation are adaptive in the sense that if you apply a magnetic field to them, the distance between these complexes can change. They optimize themselves according to the environment in which they live. So if you change suddenly the environment, well, all of these systems have to realign, and it takes weeks or at least days to do so. So if you have varying levels of magnetic fields field exposures, these systems will not be able to follow the exposure, and you will have a misadjustment of the best distance between complex 1 and 3 and 3 and 5, and you will have more ROS being generated as a result.
Do you think that the magnetic field strength can change enough to impact that system, whether you're living on the ground floor or whether you're in an apartment building on the sixth floor? Is that enough to change the magnetic field strength where you are?
You're talking about the static field or the AC field?
The Earth's static field, the static magnetic field.
Well, the Earth's field is something that we fundamentally must have a tolerance to, right? Because these magnetic reversals that we experience on the planet are not something that happens very, very frequently. And so consequently, we have to have some resistance to them. So they're not, these variations in magnetic fields are not, static magnetic fields are not as important from the point of view of disturbing physiology as the AC field. Although some people are able to demonstrate effects on cardiac instability with very low levels of changes in static fields. So static fields are biologically active, but we must have learned how to handle them. And since we have been using iron, we have had in our environment perturbations of these fields that are quite substantial. If you use a gauss meter, and if you go near your sink, probably you will see that there is a significant variation in the magnetic field levels. So this is a far cry from claiming that your whole magnetic environment changes. It is something that's momentary. But I believe that static magnetic fields are much less influential on physiology than AC fields that are completely new to our environment.
There is a difference in the Earth's magnetic field depending on where you are on the planet. And I think that gradient shifts basically from the equator to the poles. There are other geological differences in there as well, but basically it's weaker on the equator, it's stronger at the poles. Do you think this is...
Well, the European Space Agency has published a detailed map of this, and it also changes with the motion of oceans, you know, over time. So it's quite a dynamic environment. And maybe if you go from one city to another, that is part of the disturbance that you experience, you know, of the jet lag that you experience.
Well, I think that's, you know, that's exactly where I was trying to get to. I imagine that there are things that you sort of yoke with this magnetic field, whether it's, you know, temperature or availability of different wavelengths of light. You know, at the equator, you're getting much more UV. At the poles, you're getting much less. And perhaps having this magnetic field difference from the Earth is actually shaping the way that these respiratory proteins are spaced out in a way that makes them match the environment much better. Is that something that seems logical to you?
Yes, I think that in relation in particular to the natural fields, you know, there's a static field, electric field of the Earth as well that changes according to whether it's stormy or not. And the body is influenced by all of these phenomena. But those are more difficult to measure than the artificial fields purely because of instrumentation considerations. For example, the number of ions that you have in the air requires much more delicate instruments. Ground currents, you know, that circulate in the ground as a result of the power systems are also difficult to measure. So there's many things that could be influential in our lives that are less accessible simply because they are less convenient to study. And I think that what you just mentioned is one of those. We don't appreciate how electrical we are as human beings, and the variables that are difficult to measure are simply left out of our consciousness.
Speaking of things that are difficult to measure, you had a slide in your talk talking about tunneling in things like complex one in the respiratory chain. And you mentioned a couple of studies that sort of show these reaction points within the complex that are hypothetically places where electrons can tunnel. Yeah. You know, quantum coherence in biological systems is something that a lot of people find difficult to wrap their heads around, and for good reason. But it does seem very, very well, it seems more than possible that this is happening everywhere, these quantum type events. And, you know, I suspect this is, you know, just thinking logically, I would suspect that exposure to man-made fields would impact the quantum coherence inside the body and thus impact where and how tunneling can occur.
Yes, tunneling is a phenomenon that can be explained as a derivative of Maxwell's equations, which this demonstration is called evanescent waves. So tunneling is very sensitive to applied fields, basically because they are sensitive to fields at a fundamental level, and also because slight variations in distance between the in and out of a tunneling event have huge impacts on the probability and the delay within which tunneling occurs. So tunneling is sensitive to electromagnetic radiation, in my opinion. So in a sense, the quantum aspect is quite compatible with the observations that we have.
Let's say we were able to eliminate all of the man-made electromagnetic energy that we have sort of erected over the last 120 so years. We're left with things like the Schumann frequency and, like you said, the Earth's, you know, static magnetic fields and electric fields. What are these native fields contributing to biology? How are they helping us, sort of regulate ourselves?
Well, the only thing that we can guarantee is that hopefully we have grown resistant to them. But as we see with the chloroplasts, we know that living systems sometimes use the environment, even if it is hostile to their advantage. So living systems at a fundamental level, from the second law of thermodynamics, they need to have reactive oxygen species. They need to have instability. So living systems are not intolerant to instability completely. It's just that certain types of instabilities are less tolerable than others. So my opinion is that all of these fields that are natural are probably very acceptable from the point of view of public health, except for being struck by lightning, if you will. So my impression is that we are compatible with our environment. And in principle, we can be compatible with any environment that we create. But the time that it would take to be compatible, especially with an environment, the environment that we live with now, which evolves and changes continuously, is much longer than the time that technology has to change. In other words, every few years, the electromagnetic environment changes, while it would take us a couple of centuries or more to adapt to this new environment.
Can you maybe unpack the idea of an antenna for me, someone who doesn't have a background in physics, and what relevance biological antennas might have?
Well, the fact that you portray the human body as an antenna means that you will be subject and sensitive to small electromagnetic fields in the environment, which should open our eyes to possible consequences from certainly non-natural electromagnetic fields, but also to the natural electromagnetic fields, the ions that we have in the air and so on and so forth. So probably a lot of the reasons why you feel not so good according to weather, or you feel better according to weather, relates to these aspects of the environment that are actually invisible to us, but are actually there.
Are there any things in the body, or even, I know, is it FM? I think FM radio waves are roughly, they can be seen as, our bodies can be seen as an antenna for those because of the average length of the body. Are there smaller sort of molecular size antennas that might be interacting with specific man-made and electromagnetic energy?
Oh, the size of the antenna relates to the efficiency with which you capture the fields. Any size of antenna will react, in a sense, to any field. It's just that the transfer of power from the field to the biological process will not be as large. But it doesn't mean that these effects don't occur. So the antennas that you have in your mitochondria are hundreds of nanometers long. So they will probably not resonate very, very strongly at that particular frequency. It is the fact that your body is so filled with them that gives your body the property of being an antenna. If there was just one or two of these antennas in your whole body, we wouldn't have very much to worry about.
This might be a bit more of an esoteric question, but what does, you know, the ATPA spins at, I think, somewhere around 7,800 RPM, which is quite fast. And there are lots of mobile charges moving very, very quickly. And all of this is surrounded by water. What is the impact of all of this, these electrical features in the mitochondria? What are they doing to the water in that specific region? Are they ordering the water, like Jerry would suggest, that they're creating some sort of charge separation? Are the structural components of water in that milieu important for energy generation?
Well, what is important, I think, is the interaction between a proton movement and the structure of the water within an ATP molecule. And basically what I am working on now is to try to find whether there are some inhibitory fields that could allow you to stop current flow through this particular structure. This would mean that you would have a way to suppress life, essentially, by interacting with the free protons that are moving through the alpha channel.
So am I correct in thinking that the structure of the water in that ATPase is actually important for the how well the protons can be channeled through there? Is that correct?
Yes, you're right. But I will say no further. Do you have further details on this?
I appreciate that. Now, I know you've spoken to Robert F. Kennedy Jr. on his podcast, and I'm sort of wondering from a political standpoint, where are things going to go as far as, you know, protecting people from the potential dangers of, you know, the ever-increasing amount of electromagnetic fields that we're exposed to? Will we see, you know, class actions start to come up in the next decade, and how will these be handled?
This is an incredibly difficult question, because in our world, it doesn't seem that many things depend purely on science. It depends on whether individuals in position take up these causes or not. So scientifically, there is ground to ask for better protection from the public. I think this is obvious, but whether the public and the electrosensitive will obtain this protection depends on politics, right? And politics is very difficult to predict.
That's a very diplomatic answer of you. And I guess the logical follow-up would be for people who want to take as many steps as they can to protect themselves and to minimize the risks that their electromagnetic environment might be presenting them. What, from your perspective, should be done for people who are listening to this to protect themselves? You know, what are the things that they need to keep in mind?
Well, one of the things that you can do is be aware of the electromagnetic environment. And the best way to do this is to purchase a small instrument that measures both ELF and radio frequency fields. This way you can monitor for yourself what your environment is like. We call this making the invisible visible, because indeed, we are not aware that these fields are around us. So, for example, if you're a mother and you have a child, you would not expose your child to high levels of low frequency magnetic fields, because there is substantial literature that says that you'll increase the leukemia risk in that child. And so those are elementary precautions that can be taken. From the point of view of radio frequencies, the environment is increasing all the time. But it is clear that the most acute and intense exposure that you have to radio frequencies is from your own cell phone. So don't put the cell phone against your head, please. And if you can, buy a cell phone that has a low SAR rating, in other words, that is known to emit in a reasonable way. The phones by Apple are renowned to irradiate to the extreme. So those I would not recommend. And find out what the rating of your phone is before you buy it, and use it in a speakerphone mode instead of against your head. Personally, I have a cell phone here, I think, but I barely keep it charged, and I barely take it with me unless I know I'm going to need it. I know practically everybody else in the civilized world cannot go out of their home without their cell phone, and in fact can barely be separated from them, even for minutes. I asked my students during the break, would you be willing to leave your cell phones on your desk and go relax outside of the classroom? And most of them don't want to do it. They just don't want to. We have been programmed to believe that we cannot live without one. I can assure you, I live perfectly comfortably without a cell phone.
Is it generally the idea that the lower the exposure, the better it's going to be? Because I think in Arthur Furstenberg's book, The Invisible Rainbow, he suggests that there may be cases where less intensity in the field strength can actually elicit, you know, less favorable outcomes. I'd love to hear your comments on that, because I would like to think that it's sort of a linear relationship with the more the energy, the higher the readout on your device, the worse it's going to be. Is that, you know, what are your thinking? What's your thinking here?
Look, we have a long tradition of believing that there is sort of a linear dose response between exposure and health consequences. This is primarily based on our experience with chemicals. My impression is that in the case of electromagnetic radiation, it's probably more complex. I favor a view in which you have a threshold, and beyond this threshold, the increase is relatively slow. So what this would mean is that the time that you spend above a certain level of radiation is possibly more important than the level itself. But for example, in the case of low frequencies, we know that there are cancers associated with the proximity to power lines because their field is in general very sustained. It's more difficult to find associations with use of specific devices because their use is often limited in time. So there, the whole issue of how long does it take for the effect to take hold and to become stabilized in various circumstances and in various fields. So this is a complicated question, but in the absence of better data, we can assume that less exposure means less effect. And electrosensitive people are telling us that. Some people go around with clothing that shield them from the radiation, and they feel perfectly comfortable in various environments as long as the field inside their suits does not go beyond a certain level. And of course, their tolerance is also dictated by how long they stay in the field.
Do you have any specific recommendations about meters that are reliable and give accurate measurements?
Well, meters, they're all very different from one another. Some have extended frequency ranges. They're telling you that whatever G's will come in the future, we'll be able to detect them, but it's relatively rare. Most of the time, meters follow the deployment of new frequencies in a given market. The thing is that the meters are so different. They have different strengths. Some are good, better from ELF, some are better from RF, some are more omnidirectional, some have more data gathering capability. Since I have sort of an engineering background, I'm very fond of the GQEMF 390 because it has a big memory and you can monitor all the fields continuously for each second for 24 hours. And so this is the advice of a man who loves massive data in order to analyze things. But a person who wants to go around with a meter for pure protection wants to see a single number. So that's a very different requirement. You might use a coronet. There's so many of them on the market that that are able to do a decent job as long as you know their characteristics before you buy them.
Are there any specific thresholds that people should look out for if they don't have a good idea about what's, you know, what's a very high level of electromagnetic radiation and what's an acceptable level?
Well, as you know, there are people who feel these fields and they know what their threshold field is sometimes. Not every electrosensitive person is aware that they have a field beyond which they feel uncomfortable. They are mostly simply avoiding specific structures because this is less quantitative and much more easy to see. Avoid the proximity to towers and so on. So it's relatively rare that you meet electrosensitive people who know exactly what their threshold is in terms of what intensity they can tolerate for a given amount of time. And of course, you have the complexity of the various sources. You know, you have 2.5 gigahertz, you have 5 gigahertz, you have this, you have that. There's a very complex, I would say, environment out there. And it's increasingly difficult for electrosensitive people to defend themselves. Often they have to move. Often they have to spend all of their money trying to shield their apartment or buy specialized equipment. So it's very difficult for them.
So it seems to me that two of the big takeaways from this is that electromagnetic fields, man-made electromagnetic fields, can alter the structure of water, and we are mostly water in our bodies, and they can change the way that charged particles move within our body, and this is directly related to oxidative phosphorylation and the respiratory, the electron chain transport in the mitochondria, which are, both of those are so broad reaching that, you know, we really need to start paying attention to them. And I'm so grateful that you are bringing attention to them simultaneously and putting this research on such a solid foundation. I'm really glad that I have had the opportunity to speak with you, and I'm sure lots of people will have learned a lot from this. So thank you so much.
Thank you. It was a stellar salary that you just made.
Thank you so much for listening. I really hope you enjoyed this episode. I've left some links to some of Paul's work below if you'd like to learn more about his research. I've also left all of my links in the episode notes, so please feel free to subscribe and engage, as there will be much more content like this to come. Again, if you'd like to support my work, please consider subscribing to my Substack, as it is where I share most of my thoughts and insights that go beyond this podcast. The support really helps me keep this going. Thanks again for listening, everyone. Take care.